So these slides will be posted online in an hour or two. So first, how Sage interfaces with other computer algebra systems. So I've drawn this diagram. It's something I drew by hand. It's nice. Extracted directly from the source code. But what it is the following. If you look in the file Sage interfaces at expect.py, which comes with Sage, you'll find the definition of a Sage class called expect. And all of the interfaces to these other computer algebra systems derive from this one class. So there's a whole bunch of functionality in that one class that's inherited by the other interfaces. The interfaces just implement little changes or special things for each of the computer algebra systems. These are just some of the ones that are available. There are others, of course. So that's sort of what the structure's like. It's not any more complicated than that. There's expect, and then there are each of these other classes that derive from expect, and that's it. As far as the interface. But in addition to just the interface itself, there are also classes for elements of a given computer algebra system. For functions that are defined in the computer algebra system. And also for this is something that will become extremely clear when I give you some examples, but for a pair, an element and a function. And I'll give you examples that illustrate all these things. But these are the classes. So each of the interfaces really consists of a class that derives from some generic interface, and classes that derive from a generic element, generic function, element, and a generic function. So this is a particular example. If you look in the file Sage interfaces gp.py, there are classes gp, gp element, gp function element, and gp function, and they all derive from these classes that are in expect.py.
So that's the structure.
GP is for group?
No, GP is for Go Perry.
Oh, okay.
there's a Perry C library, which has been developed over a long, long, long time. Amazing, amazing program. And it has an interpreter, which is the main way that people use Perry. And the interpreter was, I think, implemented initially just as a way of testing the C library. The implementers of Perry did not think that people would use it via the interpreter. They thought that people would use it via the C library. But the C library is extremely painful to use, and the interpreter is pretty easy to use. But they gave it a really silly name, which was GP for Go Perry. Which is kind of funny because they name a lot of things in French, but I guess that's not exactly French. But
but anyway, that's what it stands for. It's probably the most confusing of all.
It should be LA Perry.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe it should be AP.
So yeah, that's what GP is.
So in Sage, there is in fact a completely new interface to the Perry C library that's written as a Python extension class, which completely avoids using GP at all. So Sage offers both this new interface to the Perry C library, which gives you the Python language to use Perry from, and the original GP interface. They both have their advantages for different things.
I mean, it's nice to still have the GP interface around because there are some really, really useful programs there. Took years to develop and are developed in the GP interpreter. And you can a number of those are included with Sage. An example is Dot Schistler's program for computing L functions in huge generality. That's a GP program. Okay, so that's the structure. And I think I'll just flash the screen and show you a little bit of each of these files. But try to keep this in mind. Spec.py, that might be too small, but I can see it. Is it okay for everybody? Okay, good. So this is the file expect.py, and there's a class called expect. Actually, there's a class browser here, so I can just click here, and it shows these are the classes that are defined in this file, and these are the functions that each class has. So for example, the expect function has a lot of different methods. The expect class has a lot of different methods, as you can see. In any case, this is some generic interface to computer algebra systems. And the other ones are, basically what you do is you define kind of a template, and For Singular, you override what some of the functions are defined here to implement certain behavior. For example, the true symbol, if you ask whether one thing is equal to another, it returns a symbol usually that represents true, and that is different in almost every computer algebra system. Some will say true with a capital T, some will say true with a lowercase t, some will say one. There are a lot of different possibilities.
Okay, so that's so the expect function is a very simple class. The function element is a simple class. Expect elements are somewhat complicated.
So what you get with these interfaces is you get a way to talk to each system, but moreover you have a way of representing an element of each system or function in one of these systems, and that's why you have these other classes like expect element. An instance of that class is it has a parent. The parent is the particular computer algebra system that it exists in, and it also has a name, this name right here, which is the name of the variable representing that element in that computer algebra system.
So I will give you an example so that that will be a little bit less mysterious. But I'll give you an example right now. So. Some need one to use the network symbol. So. Okay, so here is the new notebook interface to Sage called the Sage Web Notebook. And what you do is, you can't quite see it on the screen, but there are
gray blocks and you can type text in here and hit Shift Enter, and it evaluates that text and gives you the output. So what's happening in this example is GP, the very first line, G equals GP, what that does is it creates an instance of the GP interpreter. In other words, it creates an instance of the class GP, and the class GP just wraps running one copy of the GP interpreter. But it could, I mean, everything works the same for all the other ones. For Singular, you'd say Singular, parentheses, and you get a copy of Singular running. Print G just prints out that. It's an instance of the interpreter, and then the type of it tells you that, what file it's defined in, and so on. If I hit Shift Enter, it actually executes that code, and then this is the output. And just to give you a sense of what's going on, I can put, say, G equals there, and then hit Shift Enter, and it re-evaluates that block of code and gives you this output. Okay? Now this down here, this will give you a sense of how the other classes work. So if you say GP of anything in Sage, it will attempt to create an element in Paris that corresponds to that thing in Sage. So for example, the integer 2006, it will create the corresponding integer in Paris. And what it does is it, when you say x equals GP of 2006, it executes the line Sage, I think probably Sage 0 or something, equals 2006 semicolon in Perry, and then creates an instance of the class Perry element, and that instance of the class Perry element has a pointer to the GP interpreter in which it's defined, and the function name Sage 0. So there's a little bit of overhead there, as you can tell. So right here, when I execute this code, I'll have it print out the name of the variable as well, which will tell us what variable it is in GP. Okay, so it ran in, yeah, it's an interesting thing. So it's not Sage 0, as I said. Interestingly, in some computer algebra systems, and you don't notice this when you're just typing on the command line, but when you set up an interface like this, there's only a very limited number of different variable names that you're allowed. In some systems, you can have as many as you want. In other systems, like Perry, once you get beyond 65,000, I think, suddenly it says, sorry, no more variables are available, and the program just dies. So the trick that Mark Watkins suggested to me to get around this is to make an array and just have, instead of Sage 0, Sage 1, Sage 2 as separate variables, have them all be indices into an array and then make the array bigger as needed. So that just eliminates this problem. And that's necessary in some subset of the computer algebra systems. I can't tell you which ones off the top of my head. So that's one of the things you overload when you go from the expect class to one of the interfaces. If you need to name the variables in some special way and set up an array, you can do that.
So what this code does is it prints out the underlying name of the variable in Perry in the GP interpreter, and then it also prints the type, just so you can see, and the value of the variable. this next line, f equals gp dot factor. So most computer algebra systems don't use this object-oriented ish notation that you have in Python or Java or C++ or whatever, where in a lot of languages these days, you have some variable x. At least in many object-oriented languages, you can call a function on it by this sort of notation. You give additional arguments here. You say x dot the function name and the additional arguments. So a given object somehow has a bunch of functions associated with it. And you don't have that model in a lot of other systems. However, if you look, you'll find that most of the time, the first argument to a function in almost any of these other systems is somehow the one that really matters, and then the rest is just additional parameters. So what I did in Sage is that if you make an object in any of these other systems, in this case x, if you say x dot something, then let's say x dot foo, it just checks to see whether or not foo is a function that makes any sense in pairing. Well, actually, it doesn't even check. It just assumes that foo is a function that makes sense, for example, in GP. And then if you say x, it just returns. So x dot foo is an object, and the call method for the object, so if you explicitly try to call it with some arguments, just feeds foo, feeds this string into the interpreter that you're talking to. The name of x, and then the additional arguments. So that way you can use this object-oriented syntax, but with objects in any of the other computer algebra systems. So in this example, right here, for example, you can say x dot factor, and then you, what it does first, if you say x dot factor, without the parentheses, it creates an object, which you should think of as evaluating the function factor with the first input being x, and then the other additional arguments going on, right? Well, there's one additional argument that you use it. And then when you call that object, you get the value of factor of x, which in this case is given there. So does that make sense? It's it gives you this sort of object-oriented syntax that you can use to interact with all the systems you're used to. So it's nice because you can use exactly the same syntax you use in Python with Perry, Magma, even Mathematica, and so on. For example, you can make an integer in Mathematica. Fortunately, I never remember the command to factor an integer in Mathematica.
Is it factor an integer?
You would hope. That's more likely because that sounds more obscure. That might be. Dang it.
Probably got a capital letter.
Capital I. That's my
guess. Okay, let's try that. Factor integer. So it is. Good job. So it's factor integer. And notice that we use this nice object-oriented syntax, and then at the end, at the bottom, see, it's executing the entire block again. I'm not entering this in a different block, though. Probably for clarity, I should. So I'll just go down to the bottom. I don't have a way of inserting new blocks yet. So I input that block of code, and it outputs the factorization of this integer. But you get to use exactly the same syntax throughout all these systems. You could alternatively have written Mathematica dot factor integer of n, and that will also work. The reason it didn't print it twice is because I have to put an explicit print statement in, except for the last one. So.
You also have that. They're completely equivalent.
Well, not completely equivalent, but the effect is the same. So so that's just a little bit of the internal details of how the interface works. So the point is, let me switch back to the class diagram.
So there's this class expect. It implements a lot of basic functionality for interfacing with other systems. And for a given system, if you want to create an interface, what you do is you create a class for that system that derives from expect, and then you create these other classes, and you fill in a little details about how they work as opposed to how the generic thing works. And in practice, you don't just create your class from scratch. You look at all the systems that have been wrapped so far. This is a process that gets easier and easier as a function of time. Look at all the systems that have been wrapped so far, find which one is closest to the program you're going to wrap, and then just copy those files, change the names. So for example, if you're going to wrap MATLAB, which nobody's done yet, you could take Octave, which probably has a very similar interface, and copy the files for the Octave interface, and then make it work with MATLAB. Okay, now, please.
Permission to include mathematical functions in Sage. I mean,
It's an illusion. There's Mathematica is running separately on my machine.
I know, but then do you have to go through some loops to allow other people to use your copy of Mathematica or whatever?
I don't allow other people to use it. If you want to use the Mathematica functions here, you have to have Mathematica on your machine.
Okay, so I do, so maybe that's fine.
But Sage will find it.
If under Unix, if you have Mathematica installed, then it'll look for the math command line. You have to have the command math.
Okay, runs math. You've answered the question.
No, I haven't, because under Windows, you have to have installed Sage via Sigwin in order to have a math command line. Or maybe there isn't a math command line in Windows. I don't actually know. There's some issue there, and I'll come back to that in a bit. There's math. Under OS X, there is a math command line, but you have to do some funny business in order to tell the shell where to find it. So it works really simply under Unix, but it's more complicated under OS X and Windows, unfortunately. So basically, there's not an incredibly clever way in which it tries to find Mathematica anywhere. That said, you could be on, if you had an account on Modular, which is the computer in my office, you could do the following. I mean, not in my office, but in the basement that I have. You could say M equals run Mathematica, but on that particular computer. And it'll and you could do a command like, I don't know, our same command, M dot, actually I'll just do exactly the same.
Harvard, you got Harvard?
Oh, that's a typo, sorry. Where am I now? I'm totally confused. I've lived in 3 states in the last year. Where am I now? Washington. Okay, good. That probably would have worked though, because I do still have math. I have a modular fast Harvard EDU still. So you can make another server running on that computer, and then you can say n equals m of our number, and then you can say print n dot factor integer. And if all goes well, it will open up a connection with that machine and factor the integer. And that would have worked even if I, you know, as long as you have a network connection and an account on the machine. And for that to work without any intervention, or actually right now to work at all, you need an SSH key set up so that you could use SSH to log into the machine without typing your password. But that is, I think somebody, possibly Yi here, will improve it so that it will ask for your password if you don't have SSH key set up. And that could definitely be done. And I don't think I need Mathematica's permission to have users log into the machine and use my. I mean, all that's really happening here is it's no different than logging in via SSH to the machine using Mathematica.
Right.
But you'll be able to, you can write a program and, you know, just at the top you put, I want to use the server that's on Xeno or something. As long as you have SSH access to Xeno, it would use that. So, I mean, it's pretty fast as long as you have a reasonably, I mean, it depends on your net connection, of course. Okay, does that sort of answer your question about Mathematica?
Yeah. Okay.
All right, so back to the slides. All right, so now I'm going to tell you a little bit about the underlying trick that's used to make it so you can talk to a wide range of computer algebra systems without having to work very hard. So just to give you a sense of how hard people sometimes try to work in order to get computer algebra systems to work together, I know that I'm just aware that there are a lot of projects to try to do this that don't go very far, and a lot of money has been spent occasionally. And I think that usually people try to over-engineer solutions, and there's really a simple way, which is you simply, let's say you want to allow Sage to talk to Singular or Perry. Let's say Singular. So Singular is an open source free GPL program. You can download it, you can change anything you want if you are sufficiently patient. And you can modify it so that it has special functionality for maybe opening a server port, running in some server mode and taking commands as input and then returning the output. And possibly you could even make a direct C library interface to Singular and then link these together at runtime or at compile time, so that you can pass data directly back and forth. And you probably would think at first glance that anything besides a C library interface is going to be way too slow to be useful.
but that's not true. So that's the first way you can do it, but you end up having to write a lot in Singular, and this approach doesn't scale too well, especially if you want to apply the same strategy to, I don't know, Maple or Mathematica, which don't let you just start modifying their source code and recompiling. And also, of course, even if you could do that, you would have to distribute a modified version of Mathematica. These guys have a lot of money, and they've thought about this problem a lot, and same with Maple. They have C library interfaces that they've published, in some cases at least. I don't know about Mathematica, but definitely Maple has an interface, and you can write a C program that will use a Maple server. But Singular has no interface like that at all. In fact, there's no way to use Singular in, there's no currently no support at all in Singular for using it from a C program. So it would be hard to use from Python, or link it into Python. And there's other programs like Gap, which they also don't have any support to be used as a C library. But moreover, their memory management is crazy. And as one of the main authors, Steve Litton of Gap, said many times at Sage Days, Gap is not a good neighbor. In a sense, if you try to link a program in with Gap, Gap will just try to steal all possible memory. It's really a very unpleasant neighbor to have in the same sort of process. So you end up with a lot of complexity, because for every single one you have to write a different interface. These are just not part of the story. So another way, which is what's described here, is to use pseudo TTYs. So you know, when you use a console, you can do almost anything, in the sense that all these programs, pretty much every computer algebra system has a command line interface. Just something that you notice, Magma has a command line interface, Mathematica even has a command line interface. It doesn't like my license, that's annoying. It's a good thing I tried to run, I know what's happening. With Mathematica, it doesn't allow you to run more than one instance on the same computer, so it's complaining that it wants another license since I ran one instance in Sage. So Maple has a command line interface. These all have command line interfaces, and you could type and communicate with them as a person. So all you do is just trick all these programs into talking to you simply by simulating a command line interface using pseudo TTYs, which is just a really, really old Unix trick. So you can set up a simulated TTY, and you can use it to start up your program and run it and type into it and get info back, except all the typing is simulated by a program or is scripted by Python. There's a pure Python program that has a very large number of authors and seems to be very mature and robust at this point in time, called pexpect, and it's included with Sage. And it makes this process really, really simple. So here's an example, which is in the piece of paper that I handed out. So this is basically, this example plus one observation in this example is all you need to really get going and write interfaces to everything. And it's just a lot of work tedium, but once you've done it, you've got interfaces to a large number of systems. So, and that's what I've been systematically doing. So you import the pexpect module. So in Python, you say import and then a library name that makes all the functionality of that library available. But it doesn't sort of override any variables that you have in your current interpreter. In order to use the functions that are in this library, you say pexpect dot, and then you get the name of any of the functions or objects or whatever that are in this library. So the first line, p equals pexpect dot spawn, it runs this command line and sets, using a pseudo TTY, it sets up a basically a simulated console that's or like a simulated TTY that is talking to GP. So it starts a GP interpreter instance, and it can send any input it wants to that, and it can wait for whatever output it wants until it sees certain characters in the output stream, and then it gives you back those characters. This next line is utterly crucial. What this does is turns on buffering for I/O. And the default in pexpect is to have that off. And interestingly, the speed is about a factor of 1,000 or so different if you're sending, you know, a few thousand characters each way. For a long time I thought the whole pexpect idea for doing interfaces was almost completely useless because it would be way too slow, but it was useful in a few special cases, so I tried it out. But one day I was just browsing around in the documentation, I noticed this Maxre thing, and I decided to just, you know, at random kind of change it to 2 or 3 instead of 0, which is the default, which was no buffering. And suddenly it was 1,000 times faster than before. So I was very, very, very impressed. And then I suddenly realized, wow, this is actually a potential way of doing something interesting. And actually the reason I wrote the first interface, the very first interface I wrote was for Mathematica, and the reason was because there's no incomplete gamma function in any open source program I could find at the time. So it's just a sort of generalization of the gamma function. There was no implementation of it where you could allow complex arguments, whereas that's a standard thing in Mathematica. And I needed this incomplete gamma function for some graphs that I was drawing for Barry Mazur, for a talk he was going to give. So I just desperately needed it, so I wrote this interface to Mathematica. And even though it was really slow because I didn't know about the Maxre parameter, it got the job done. And incidentally, I mentioned that recently, and one of the Perry authors was in the audience and said, oh, we added up to Perry, so now there is an incomplete gamma function. In any case, so that was the first interface, and then I added another, I think I added an interface to GAP because David Joyner really, really wanted an interface to GAP. He uses GAP a lot and has written a lot for GAP. And by the way, David Joyner is going to be here for a week in June, next month. So anyways, I wrote an interface to GAP, and then we realized that we could include GAP, have an interface to it, and then suddenly we have huge, you know, 20 years worth of hard work on group theory functionality just available in Sage, just like that. And then we decided to do that with some other systems. Before any of this happened, I had written a C library interface to Perry, just because I didn't want to reinvent the wheel number theory-wise. But I had no idea that you could do that with all these other systems efficiently. But in fact, you can. And when you do timing tests, you find that this expect interface idea works pretty well. It works really well as long as the input lines that you're sending aren't too big. If you try to send, say, a 10,000 character line to GAP, it will simply freeze because it will not accept an input line that's bigger than about 4,000 characters. So what you do when you give input to GAP, you have a little sort of special case, which is one of these things you put in the derived classes. You say if the input line is bigger than a certain number of characters, I mean 4,000 or something, write the input line to a file. You know how to read in a file in GAP. You just do that. So, and it works really well. But running on a remote machine, writing to a file, there's an additional situation, you know, complexity that's involved there. So I think there I use scopy, which is really slow, to copy the file over. Write it to a file, scopy it over to the other machine. Redid it. But that can be improved for sure. Okay, so just explaining this code a little more. This sets the buffering. This waits for a question mark. Waits for a backslash, a question mark, and then a space. And by the way, I don't run GP just with the default. An interesting thing is that most computer algebra systems have like a bunch of command line arguments that will put it in a very generic state where it can be where you can parse the output of command lines a lot more easily than in the default. So, for example, GP, the default GP, if you run it, which I'll show you right now, with no command line options, it starts up, but it has, notice that the question mark is a different color. So it embeds, maybe you can't see that, but trust me, the question mark is brown. And see how it's brown? So there's some special color information in there. That really throws off trying to parse the ASCII input and output. And there's all kinds of readline stuff. So there's all kinds of special codes. They're kind of a pain in the butt. So you just turn them all off by running GP in, basically the key thing is Emacs mode. So there's an Emacs interface to GP. And so they wrote a special, you know, mode for GP called Emacs mode, and that just happens to turn off all the crap. So you just notice that. And in every other system, we've noticed something similar. In GAP, there were some neat things we'd like to do, like it has tons of examples of usage, but the examples have the output prompt in them. And there's no way to change the, doesn't seem to be a way to change the output prompt in GAP. So how can you sort of safely get help about the GAP functions when the help itself confuses the expect system? I mean, basically what happens is you send some input and then you wait for the output to finish. But how do you know when it's done? You don't just want to sit there and wait until there's a pause of 1 second because maybe the calculation takes 2 seconds. And you don't want to wait until you see maybe just a question mark because it's like a GP, the output prompt is a question mark because maybe that's a question mark is part of the output of the function. So it might say something, are we done yet? And then dot, 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 something like that. So you have to either change the prompt or embed some special escape characters into the output stream, which is what you can do if you can modify it. I mean, if you think about it, even as a user, it can be hard to know when a program has stopped sending you output.
We could take advantage of, well, yeah.
What happened with Gap is that Steve Linton at Sage Days wrote during the coding sprint modifications to the Gap kernel that put it in a mode that will put special escape characters in the output stream. And then we included that modified version of Gap in Sage for a while until it became part of the main version of Gap. And it would make sense to do something more along the lines for Perry. But right now, it's been okay just checking for, well, in the special mode, backslash and a question mark in the space. But you could, if you know that that is what it's checking for, you could certainly write something that would throw it off. However, if you make some modifications to the GP interpreter, which you could do, I mean, it's open source, pretty easy to modify, then you could fix this. And that's the sort of thing that's on the to-do list. The next thing this does, this isn't using Sage at all, by the way. This is just using Python. The next thing it does is, after it sees the question mark, it sends the factor string, sends a command we want to execute to GP, then it waits for a prompt, and then it gets everything up to that prompt and prints it, and that's what you see here. That's everything after the first prompt, and after you sent that, it echoed its output. So you have to put it on. But this is the output, and you can be more cleverly format the output, so, or tell Perry to format its output, so it's easier to work with than this. But, then you wait for the next prompt, and then you can say, pronounce something, and you can close the session. So using pxpect, you can just script anything. And by some just many, many, many hours of trying to actually solve real problems using this, you eventually end up with interfaces to almost every system out there that work in a nice, coherent manner, and the ability to add new interfaces easily. But the key point is just that by using expect, going back to this slide, you've done things in such a simple, incredibly simple and generic way that you can script almost anything with ease, or that you can set up an interface with almost any other system. You don't need any access to Magma source code, or you don't have to have special versions of these other programs. It helps to have special versions, like what happened with Gap, but it's not necessary. So, even with Maple, there's some like testing mode that you can put it in, and the testing mode, which is what they use for testing your own documentation, I think, is perfect for Sage to interact with Maple. So it has lots of the appropriate codes in it. Okay, so that's pxpect, and this is the example I just showed you. Show it again. And now just to summarize, these are a whole bunch of issues with the interfaces to the other systems and difficulties that we've overcome. Some we've overcome and some we haven't. And once I finish telling you this, then I'll tell you about interfacing people with Sage instead of the computer algebra systems. So this whole idea of interfacing computer algebra systems with other computer algebra, or interfacing Sage with other systems, makes the possibilities for user interfaces better. And in fact, one of the crucial connections here is like this. So, one thing that caused me a lot of headaches was getting a process to quit. So, some programs, especially Maple, don't. So, as soon as you start up Maple, it starts up a Maple server. And that Maple server is a completely different process. And if you just kill this Maple, the Maple server doesn't die. So, what happens with pxpect by default is when you kill the object, when the object goes away, or when the Sage quits, it would just kill the process that you started. But the process you started is not the actual Maple kernel, so you end up with these Maples sitting around, which is really, really annoying. But you just there's another command that allows you to kill process and the entire process group, I think, which kills all the children. So you just have to add in some extra stuff to do that, and it works. But this did take me a while to test in a lot of different cases to make sure it would work well. Another thing I've already mentioned is that IO prompts. You know, if the input prompt is a question mark, well, you want to change it to something really obscure, so otherwise you'll get confused. Input prompts vary a lot. Like in some systems, they have a number in them. There's some complicated formulation involving a number and lots of strings. It just varies hugely. Whereas in others, it's just like a little greater than some.
Large.io, I mentioned that already. The trick, instead of having the thing hang, which is what happened a long time, we didn't know why, you just write things to a file and load them back in
when you have large input or output.
Remote servers, that is possible. I haven't tried to get people to use this very much, but I think the only reason I haven't is that I'm a little worried because it might not be as robust as I would like. But I think that definitely this would be made much more robust. And then when people want to run something that requires Magma, instead of logging in, if it's just one little piece that requires Magma, for example, they can get an account on my machine, because for they have a reason to, and then they just set something up in their Sage configuration, and they'll be able to sort of just, it'll automatically use the Magma on my machine rather than the Magma that they don't have locally. And likewise with some of the other systems. So this could be a cost-saving but legal and convenient way for students to use software that they can so easily use otherwise.
That was kind of what my question about mathematical.
Yeah, and exactly the same holds for mathematical. So of course you'll have to have, the server machine will have to have a license to run an arbitrary number of Mathematica processes, or if it only runs one, then you'll have an error message which says, sorry, you have to wait until the other student's done using Mathematica. But it's the same as if you were to log in.
Yeah.
This is giving, I mean, you already have this, but it's not so convenient to have to log in via SSH to use Mathematica, because it's annoying because you want to work in a workbook environment. That's what people like. I didn't think I liked it, but I'm one of these people, and I just wrote this thing last week with Alex, earlier this week with Alex, and it's a notebook environment for Sage, which I'll show you, I'll talk about more in a second, but I actually like it more than the command line already. So I think I like a notebook interface now. And if you SSH into another machine and then run Mathematica, you just have a command line. You can window back if you have things set up correctly, but there's a lot of slowness involved in that.
Okay. Let's see, whoop, sorry.
What else is there? And hopefully, does everybody here know everybody here? Because probably should. Let's just take a quick pause. So, let's see if I know everybody here. This is Tom Boothby, and I just hired him to work on Sage. He knows a lot about web design and JavaScript and programming in general. So he's hopefully going to do a lot more on the web interface this summer. Excellent. Yeah, very, very good. This is Aaron Clem, who runs MathForge and works at the video game programming place in Redmond called DigiPen. And this is Jim Morrow, who everyone knows. He's a professor here. And Robert Bradshaw, who's a grad student here, who's interested in number theory. And he's doing a student project in my class on the elliptic curve factorization method, or a program that implements the elliptic curve factorization method. And Yi King is writing something for doing, have you ever heard of GIMPs, this thing where you can factor integers on it? You can run a screensaver on your computer and it'll work on trying to find a large prime number. So we want to do something like that with Sage, where you can set up actually interesting calculations and have them easily exported to a lot of computers. People can volunteer their computer to work on this, and he's trying to set up something nice and generic like that in Python. And one example thing you could do would be which would be with Robert, would be to script something where GMPECM is run on a whole bunch of different machines to factor an integer. So you guys should meet each other. And this was Edwin O'Shea, who's a grad student, I think a six-year grad student in algebraic geometry of, who's your advisor? Rick Thomas, okay. And he knows a huge amount about Macaulay 2, which is a symbolic computer algebra system similar to Singular, which I've been working very hard with the authors to try to get into Sage. And this is Chuck Duran, who's a professor here who started last year. And this is Bobby, what's your last name?
Moretti.
What's your last name?
Moretti.
Bobby Moretti, who I just hired also, who is a big open source fanatic. Not sure exactly what you're going to do. We'll see. okay, so everybody knows everybody now, which is good. All right, so as I was saying, another funny problem is, here's another issue that came up, which took a while to figure out what to do with. Magma, you can call a function in Magma, and the number of return values is sort of unknown. I mean, you don't know how many values the function will return.
You know, functions would always return one thing, one variable. But in Magma, they designed this really funny language where you have a function such as, here's an example, is prime. Is square. So here's an example of a function called Magma. So it will set this to be true, and it will set that to be 3. So if this function returns 2 values, there's no way to query the function and ask how many values it returns. And moreover, the number of values it returns can depend on the input. So it can be pretty tricky. And I remember overhearing somebody at the Magma conference in Paris saying, I don't know if I like that. To my computer science-ish guy. Python has a more elegant solution, which is you return multiple arguments by putting them in a single tuple, and then you can unpack a tuple by just, if you say tn equals a 2 tuple, it assigns to t the first entry of the tuple and the second entry. But anyways, you have to figure out a good way of wrapping this in the interface, and basically what you do is you just add an additional, when you call this in
Sage, I'll show you what you do. I'm just going to get a new little box to type into here. I'll say, let's see, I want to do this. Magma.isSquare 9 nVals equals 2. That means it should get 2 return values on. And it does. If I say probably nValues equals 1, I think it'll give an error or something. Oh, it just gets the first one. So it gives you a way of dealing with this problem, which is kind of nice. But for a long time, you could only get the true. You couldn't get anything else out. So. I think it would, let me see, whoops, nVals equals 2. I'll show you. Oops. So there's what it does. So that's not exactly trivial to parse. You really don't know whether it's one or two operands. It could be, and you just get it as a string, so.
And it's only separated by a space, you split on the space and it returns your tuple.
Yeah, but what if the first thing in a string represents? Well, first you're not getting back a string when you do this, you're assigning to a variable. When I give this command right here, what it's doing is it's creating
two objects in Magma, or one object in Magma, and then then it tries to get the string representation, that's when it prints this out. But you're not actually just looking at the string, you're actually looking at the actual objects. And it's kind of interesting. So if I do that, if I say t equals is square, it simply doesn't even, it actually, I think it doesn't even compute the 3 in that case. It knows that you asked for only one input and it only computes that. Whereas if you do this, then it computes both t and m. So it's pretty clever. I mean, it's a sensible thing to do, I guess. But and you can't, so when you say nVals equals 2, it does this, and you say nVals equals 1, it does that. So that's really the right, I think what I did is the right thing. But it really, from a programming point of view, I think it would be a lot better for is square to take an optional argument telling you whether or not it should compute the actual square, rather than having the behavior depend on how many outputs you ask for, which is kind of funny for a function. What? Really? That's a good reason not to do it. Sorry to Perl people. I mean, as far as just, well, Perl isn't about doing things right. It's about making it, I don't know what Perl's about, but doing it. It's just about doing it. So start doing on time. All right, so that's everything about, this is just how to create a new interface. I've already told you this in words. Basically, you just copy some code from a previous one, and then you're off to go.
These are some ideas. If you want to improve an existing interface,
a really good way to do it is to take a standard tutorial about that program, like Singular or something, sit down for a few hours, work through the tutorial, and find that there's a lot of things that don't quite work right or they're frustrating to use from the Sage interface, and list all of them, and then fix them, or tell me about them, and let me fix them. This is an algorithm which would, if it were to be worked through carefully with a whole bunch of these, would result in a bunch of documentation, because you would record what you do, and b, it would improve all of the interfaces a lot. And I did this myself with some of them, and I got some students at UCSD to do this in some cases, for example, with Maple, but it could be iterated more than once. And if you have no idea what to do with Sage, here's a good idea. Another thing, tab completion should work. Another third thing is, if you have an interface like Singular, and you have some Sage object like a matrix, if you try Singular of that matrix, you should get something meaningful in Singular. And if you don't, then there's some work to do, because there could be a conversion function to do that, and that could be added to Sage. So there's tons and tons of possibilities for that. The way it works now is that you hope that there's been a nice conversion function written for whatever you want to do. If there isn't, you have to do it by hand by creating the appropriate string to feed into Singular. Fortunately, Python has a lot of support for string processing, much more than your typical computer algebra system. So you can get the string representation of whatever your object is, and write a little bit of Python code that will represent it or construct the appropriate thing in whatever computer algebra system you're working with, like Mathematica or something, and then plug it right in there. So, but if you do write one of those, then you can send it to me, and I can make it so it's just built into the system. By the way, I want to show you some ways in which Sage can be a better way to use another system. So in Magma, the introspection, that is getting, say, the functions that you can call on a given thing, is not very good. So we're in Magma right now. I have an elliptic curve. I'll make one, say 1, 2. Okay, so there's an elliptic curve. That's a good example. Let me choose a curve for which I know a point on it. Let's see. Sorry, elliptic curve. Kimono database. No, I don't know how to do this anymore. Actually, I can't remember. I'll just do this 1, 2. Let's say I want to compute the torsion subgroup. So that works, but what if I want documentation on that function? I get a whole bunch of documentation. There are a lot of different torsion subgroup commands. There's actually, looks like, about 7 or 8 different commands called torsion subgroup. It's overloaded. The type of the argument tells what torsion subgroup command should be called. And in Magma, you just get help on something, you say torsion subgroup semicolon, and you get every single one. And there are other functions like order, where it's really disturbing how many you get. Look. So, and that was, you know, that's a lot of different. So what you do is you end up looking through this, trying to track down which one's relevant, and hoping that the documentation isn't empty. It's sort of painful. Now, the Sage interface to Magma is a little nicer because, as I'll show you in a second, if you say Magma, if you make the elliptic curve in Magma that we just made, like this, oh, I have to give this as a string. Oops. What did I do wrong? I forgot the equal sign. Pretty important. So now I can say, there are two neat things I can do. One is I can say, first in Magma, there's no easy way to figure out what all the functions are you can call on an elliptic curve. What are the functions that take an elliptic curve as their first argument? There's no way to do that. Sage can do that. And it does that, as you'll see in a second, I hope. So it's showing all the functions that take an elliptic curve as the first argument. And the way it does that is it makes, it goes through and it makes a list of every single function in Magma, and then it's, you know, it sorts through and finds the ones that start with the elliptic curve signature. So it has a list of all of them. So you can say e.tor and tab complete. But you can also say e.torsion subgroup there. Now this is a function element. It's a combination of if I say f equals that, this thing I just made is a function element. That is, it's a function and an element together. And there's a method which will give you the documentation for that. And what it does is it sifts through all the documentation for a torsion subgroup and just gives you the ones that have this as the first, has that sort of signature as the first input. So you can sneakily, by some work for a couple of hours, write something in Python that allows you to have a better interface to Magma than Magma has, as far as being able to interactively get documentation about objects that you're working with. So here you get an abelian group, and then you can say a.tab, and it gives me all the functions that I can call in an abelian group, such as order. Then I say a.order, and instead of getting 1,000 different orders, I get just the orders that are relevant to abelian groups.
So that's just some clever, cool trickery you can do via Python if you decide that you, well, anyways, just kind of fun. Okay, so let's see. Seems like I've given the first half of my talk in an hour. But the second half is only about three or four slides. So it's really pretty quick. So now I'm going to talk, let's see. Can I have 10 minutes? Good, or you have to leave. Good. That's okay. So if this is exactly for you.
Yeah, this is fine.
Do you have to leave right now?
No.
Okay. I will finish, I promise, at exactly 6:10. Okay? All right, okay, go ahead. Thanks for, see you later. Please leave if you have to go. I apologize profusely for going 10 minutes over. Probably some people don't mind.
So then I just have somewhere I have to be.
Go, okay, go. Great, because we only have 1 minute. Okay, good. All right, so I'll talk for at least 10 more minutes. And I think I can tell you what I want to tell you in that amount of time. So there are currently three interfaces to Sage. One uses CGI bin scripts, and it's this one that I've probably showed you before, which is, this is online calculator. You can put any code you want in here, like 2 plus, or like factor, or 2006, and then click Sage, and it runs a complete Sage process, gets back the answer, and prints it out. And you can put, you know, a big chunk of code in here, like n equals 5, m equals 7, n plus m, or print n plus m, and 4i in range 10. And you can do a whole bunch of things. Print I, and then click evaluate, and it evaluates it. It doesn't remember anything from a previous call. Like if you say print n now, it's just going to give an error, because it doesn't know what n is anymore.
So that's a really simple thing. It started about,
I wrote it about, I don't know, way before I wrote Sage. So I wrote this about 2.5 years ago. And I wrote it mainly because students in number three classes that Keith Conrad and me were teaching wanted to use Paris to do some of the assignments, but we didn't want them to have to suffer through installing Paris on their computer. So to make things really simple, they could just go to a web browser and type in some stuff and get an output, and it just, you know, it's just a lot easier if you're extremely busy undergrad, you don't want to worry about installing some weird, hard to install piece of software. So that's how it started. It just uses Apache 2 and a couple of simple CGI bin scripts, and it's simple enough to set up that a number of other people have set it up around the world. One thing is I couldn't get change root to work correctly when I first made this calculator, so I told a bunch of my friends about it and said, can you figure out how to execute an adapt command in Paris that will allow you to at least do arbitrary things as user Apache? And sure enough, some people found some amazingly clever hacks that allowed them to execute code, because I put things in that got rid of the obvious commands that wouldn't execute code that had the obvious commands that might allow you to do system calls. But people still found some funny ones. For example, look what GP does. I'm going to go into the GP interpreter. So this, by the way, this calculator, it's crucial that I tell you this calculator executes Perry code in addition to GP code. I mean, in addition to Sage code. And this calculator was around executing Perry code long before Sage was written. But look what you can do. In Perry, so here's a perfectly good function, the sine function. And there's another function, system of dot, like ls. LS. I don't understand why. Yeah, you're right. Yep. Now look what happens if you input that funny command. What do you think it'll do? Amazingly, it just strips out all the spaces. So, yeah, that was one of the ones I didn't notice for a long time. But that was one of the cleverest, most clever hacks of Perry for executing arbitrary code. I also had a Magma version, but then,
so this thing would allow you to execute both Magma code and Perry code, and I got explicit permission to execute Magma code, but it had to, no matter what happened, it had to time out after 20 seconds, and it could use at most a very limited amount of memory. And I imposed those conditions using ulimit, but then one friendly winter day, in San Diego, so it was actually nice and sunny. John Cannon from Australia, where it was also nice and sunny then, wrote and said that he formally advised me with permission to use his calculator ended on December 31st. And that really took me by surprise, because
a lot of people were really enjoying using it for a few seconds, and it was great because I could tell people about my modular forms code and say, hey, just go use this calculator, you can try it out. And it was pretty popular, actually very popular. I logged all inputs, I could see how much it was being used and how it was being used, and it was extremely popular. So I was very happy to be providing some limited glimpse into the neat numbers rate that Magnum provides. So he said, no, you can't do that anymore. Of course, understandable. There's no license agreement, as far as I can tell, with Magma, but makes sense that they can control the distribution of this copyrighted program. But the most disturbing thing is they said that, note that this does not affect use of Magma in your modular forms site. So I have a modular forms database, and it uses Magma in order to reformat certain tables into other formats, uses it to compute dimensions of spaces and modular forms on the fly, and so on. This is something that you don't have arbitrary access to Magma, but you have some limited, it uses Magma as a backend. And they said that they're not likely to withdraw permission for that use of Magma. And that made me really nervous because it meant that they fully feel that they at any time can withdraw permission for me to use Magma just as a backend to reformat tables and modular forms that I happen to have stored in a Magma readable format I want to make available on the web. So that made me extremely nervous and made me work on Sage harder. Okay, so that's the first interface, and perfect timing. The second interface is this AJAX interface, which you just click here, lots of people can connect at the same time, and you get the Sage command line, just like that. So, and anybody in the world can just connect to this whenever they want. And the way it works is the following. Aaron in the back of the room searched somewhere online and found something called AJAX term, which is linked to at the bottom of this website. And AJAX term is an AJAX application written entirely in Python, and of course there's JavaScript on the users on the client side. And I just downloaded these. It's a pretty small program, so I downloaded these, made a number of modifications. The AJAX term was meant to basically run SSH on a machine, and I just downloaded it, made some modifications so that what happens, so that there's a single Python process running on modular. It's not running in a change root environment or anything, so it has to open up this port. And I don't know how to open up a port from a change root environment, at least the way I have it set up. I should say in the Sage calculator, I now run code that people execute in a change root jail, which means that it doesn't matter if they try to change a lot of things, it's still completely jailed so that, it's a technical thing.
What this does is when you connect to this website, it just immediately starts an instance of Sage running in a change root jail, and that's what you see here.
And it's exactly the same Sage interpreter that gets run from the CGI bin script calculator. They all run the same install of Sage. Notice that I don't allow you to run Magma from here, at least I hope I don't, because that would... I did notice that people suddenly started trying to use this other calculator, the previous one, to see if they could run Magma through Sage, and I'm pretty sure that's not allowed. So I just made sure not to install Magma into the change root environment in which Sage runs. But basically, that's what it does. When you connect, it starts up a Sage process. It took me a couple of hours, though, at least, to figure out how to get that to work correctly. Because I didn't want to just throw this up without having things in a change root environment. Because you can say os.system. I mean, in Python, in Perry, you can reasonably expect to scan for input that could be malicious. But in Sage, there's interfaces to all these other systems. It's completely hopeless that you're going to be able to scan for malicious input. But this is all happening in a change root jail. That's a picture of the directory structure of a change root jail. I'm not so worried about that thing getting messed up. It wouldn't be a serious problem. Maybe I should be, but I'm not, for the convenience of the world. Okay, so that's the second interface, and then the third interface is the new one. So it's the Sage Web Notebook, and here it is, right here, and it's what I've been showing you the whole time. And all this is about 200 lines of Python code that's part of Sage, it's included in Sage. And to get it to work, you just take the latest version of Sage, which is 1.3.0.1, and you type Sage, And then there's a command server HTTP1, which you can't see because everything's not visible.
You type question mark and it tells you, it actually doesn't document all the functions, but there's a whole bunch of different options. And
you just start it, basically. You give a port that you want it to run on, such as 8,117, and maybe a name to save everything in, so ABC. And you just start it, and it just starts a web server running directly in Python. Python includes a web server as part of the standard base library of Python. And there you are, you have, just go to, with your web browser to that URL, and you can then type in code and hit shift return, and it executes whatever block of code you type in. So you could type, you know, n equals 5, m equals 7, n plus m, and you get 12. And you can still access the variables from the previous line and the next line and so on. What's actually happening here is the Sage instance in which we started the server used this interface, started up another copy of Sage, and that's the one that's being scripted. And that's the one that you're actually defining variables in and calling things in. And it actually works really nicely. Everything's saved as you go. If you were to immediately kill the power to my computer, everything here that I've done so far has been saved. At least the text of what I've done has been saved. It doesn't actually save the Python objects, but it saves the text. And finally...
And a different interface would still find all that stuff, is that right? So I wouldn't have to use the web browser to...
Yeah, all that stuff is saved as just an object you can load into Python. So, for example, if I just kill this, what it returns is the underlying
string representation of the thing that stores all the input and output. And I can make I could also make it outputted in a text format, so that you could just read it with any text editor. So
the final slide is the problem. Well.
This thing's really nice because multiple people can connect at once. There's some issues to work out. But basically, you can set up a little server like this with your version of Sage, have 10 different people connect to it, and they can interact with the same objects. It's like a chat room that anybody can just fire up whenever they have Sage installed on your machine.
This is available right now, is that right?
Yeah, it's in the version I just released a few minutes ago, Sage. But there's a lot of problems since it's very new, and I really want help, especially from Tom. This is a to-do list for that server. So you need to add authentication. So if you start up one of these servers, but make it something that anyone in the world can connect to, which you can do just as well as doing it locally on your laptop, you don't want anyone in the world to just connect to it unless you're running the thing in a change root environment, and you probably don't want to. Always do that. So it would be good to add authentication. I have no clue how to do that. Just the way that JavaScript works could be refined a lot, like have shrink expand, just copy all the things Mathematica does basically. It would be nice to be able to type in blocks of plain text that don't get evaluated. You should be able to interrupt running calculations directly from the web interface. That is a tricky problem. And I think I know how to solve it, but it's quite tricky.
So basically the problem is this. So you're sitting here and you want to factor 2 to the power of, whoops, I killed the server, so I have to go back to one that's still running. It's not going to work if I kill the server. If I say factor 2 to the power of 987 minus 1, well, that's kind of a hard calculation. It's just going to sit there. There's nothing I can do to kill the process as it is now. I mean, there actually is something I can do, but I can type control C here. And then I can go back here and I can hit refresh. And it does correctly kill it while maintaining the sanity of what's going on. Like all the variables from before are defined. However, that's not a very good interface, and you should be able to do it directly from the web browser. So that's a major problem that I think can be solved. But it's a tricky problem for interrupting or running.
It would be really good to have a nice animation while the calculation's proceeding. An artist could make that. Like a little animated GIF or something, like PNG that shows things are going. And then there's some other issues. Like, it would be nice to embed graphics in the output. It would be nice to embed LaTeX stuff in the output. Be able to easily download an exact log. You should be able to download and upload objects into the session that have been saved. Anyways, it's a whole bunch of things that are all doable, I think, but they all need to be done. And then I need to get a lot of testing and feedback in order to make this the canonical interface for Sage. Okay, now I'm done, and I'm basically on time. Okay, so I'll hopefully see you guys next Thursday or meet with me earlier.
Thursday at 4?
Yes. Yeah.